China certainly thinks it has changed the balance, and it may be overinterpreting the results.
Fallout continues from Taiwan's election. It's Tuesday, November 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Mumbai remembers a deadly terrorist attack. Chinese officials face fraud allegations in Kenya. Tariffs flatten beer profits. Avoiding chemotherapy. Ranchers deal with climate change. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The ruling party in Taiwan received a message this weekend to show more achievements, including engagement with the island's old nemesis, China, as the opposition camp swept midterm elections. The Democratic Progressive Party of President Tsai Ing-wen lost all but six mayoral and county magistrate seats Saturday, the first electoral test of its 2 years in the presidency. 15 seats went to the opposition Nationalist Party, which wants closer ties with China. The ruling party advocates for more distance. China claims sovereignty over self-ruled Taiwan, causing decades of friction between the two sides. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Richard Bush, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He served almost 5 years as the chairman and managing director of the American Institute in Taiwan, the mechanism through which the United States government conducts substantive relations with Taiwan in the absence of diplomatic relations. He asked Bush if the results of the election changed the balance of power between Taipei and Beijing.
I really think that remains to be seen. China certainly thinks it has changed the balance, and it may be overinterpreting the results and viewing the results through the lens of relations across the Taiwan Strait. One can interpret the results of these elections as very much domestic and even local. And they were local elections. Cross-strait relations, policy towards China, actually wasn't that much of an issue in the races for magistrates and mayors and so on. It was more domestic things. Certainly, the results were a commentary and a judgment on President Tsai's leadership, but I think it was more leadership on domestic issues rather than external ones.
Now, is it the style of leadership, do you think, that led to this, or was it just economic numbers, or was it everything?
It's partly the style of leadership. President Tsai has a kind of cool charisma, but she is sort of low-key. This annoyed more radical people in her party, and that may have led many of them just to stay home on election day rather than to come out and vote for their candidate. We don't know that yet. There was opposition in the public to some of the DPP's initiatives on same-sex marriage, on energy policy, on transitional justice, and so on. All of these are serious policy issues. There are no easy answers to any of them. Sort of the voters seem to have wanted, in a conservative way, to pull the DPP back from some of its policy impulses.
Well, you know that one of the things that gained a lot of headlines here in the United States was the rejection of the same-sex marriage referendum. What happened there?
The DPP probably could have passed a same-sex marriage law when it came into office in 2016. But I'm told that there are actually divisions within the party on same-sex marriage, some people didn't want to go too fast. There was also opposition in the KMT. There was opposition from some religious groups. So this was not a slam dunk ever. Moreover, the status quo is that civil unions are legal. And so more conservative voters might have said, you know, that's enough. That deals with the problem without going too far. Finally, I'm told that anti-gay organizations in the United States actually funnel quite a bit of resources to anti-same-sex marriage forces in Taiwan.
There are reports that China tried to influence the election. Are those reports true, as you understand it?
I think they are true. They have ways of penetrating into Taiwan's political system with money, through traditional media, and through social media. And that was certainly at play. Figuring out how much of an impact it had is really hard. And, you know, it may have been that it created as much a negative reaction towards China as moving politics in China's direction.
China just seems to be ratcheting up, or is it just the same, on the same level of disagreement with the very existence of Taiwan?
I think that they don't like the DPP government. They don't like Tsai Ing-wen, and they are liable to continue the pressure that they have exerted against her and her government. At the same time, they will probably try to create links with KMT mayors and magistrates, particularly on economic issues, as a way of further burrowing into the Taiwan political system. Whether that sort of serves them well in the end is another question.
But you don't see it ratcheting up to any kind of military action or something like
No. I mean, the purpose of its intimidation campaign has been to avoid the need of any sort of military action.
Richard Bush, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now if you visit voanews.com. Taiwan election results pressure ruling party to take action toward China. South Korean MPs land on disputed isle, prompting Japan protest. Chinese officials arrested for bribery amid Kenya's SGR corruption inquiry. 145 pilot whales die in stranding on New Zealand beach. Australia seeks to make stripping citizenship easier. Expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Indians have marked the 10th anniversary of the deadly Mumbai attacks carried out by Pakistani militants on India's financial capital in 2008 that left 166 dead and hundreds wounded. Wreaths were laid by officials at the Mumbai attack memorial. The three-day attack, known commonly by its date 2611, targeting a luxury hotel, the city's main railway station, a Jewish center, and a restaurant popular with tourists, was finally put down with all but one of the attackers killed. In a statement Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed America's solidarity with the people of India, especially the families of the victims. Six Americans were among those killed. He called it an affront to those who have suffered, that those who planned the Mumbai attack have still not been convicted. He called on the global community, especially Pakistan, to sanction those responsible for the atrocity. Rafiq Dasani is the RAND Corporation Director of Asia-Pacific Policy and a senior economist. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the attack occurred as longtime antagonists India and Pakistan were seeking improved relations.
This particular attack, largely blamed on or inspired by the Pakistani army, delivered a severe setback to India-Pakistan relations, which, you know, has been vitiated by the situation in Kashmir for many decades now.
There were 10 attackers, 9 were killed, 1 was captured alive, but those who planned it apparently still are at large.
So this is the organization Lashkar-e-Tayyaba that was disclosed by one of the attackers, the only one who was captured alive, as being the mastermind of the attacks. It's a group that's been banned. Its leader lives within Pakistan. So it's a situation where India and other countries, the U.S. included, which whose citizens lost lives in the attack, have asked Pakistan why they're not bringing this organization to book, why Hafiz Saeed is not brought to justice. You know, it's a difficult situation at best, given the weakness of the political environment in Pakistan and how beholden the country's affairs are to the army.
Could the military bring these people to justice if it chose to?
Yes, it could. If it chose to is a difficult term to apply to Pakistan's military, because it's not clear that it has a unified command other than a desire to maintain its political power within the Pakistani political setup. But that said, it itself is highly conflicted within. There's the ISI, which works in a certain direction. There's no political control, there's no civilian control, and there appears to be no unified military control of Pakistan's army. So to say that if the army wants to do something is itself a difficult question, you know.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Sunday issued a statement calling on Pakistan and the entire international community to take action against those responsible for the attacks. Washington's offering a new reward of $5 million to help secure their capture. Will this help?
This coming after Pakistan was removed from the U.S. Department of Defense's sort of security aid list. They apparently $1.66 billion of military-related aid to Pakistan has been withdrawn by the Trump administration. So one can look at this as saying, well, you know, this is the reason why we are not continuing the aid, and if you bring the perpetrators to book, we will bring relations back on track. Or it could be viewed as saying, we've given up on you, Pakistan, here's one more dump. And I'm afraid that within Pakistan, it's probably going to be viewed as the latter. And therefore, then no action will be taken in response to this.
Rafiq Dasani said Indo-Pakistani relations today could not be worse after reaching a high point following Kashmir elections in 2002. He said that is particularly alarming given the fragile state of the Pakistani civilian leadership and the fact that both countries are nuclear powers. Happening now in Asia, Taiwanese officials say mechanical issues and speeding caused the deadly train crash that killed 18 passengers and injured more than 180 in late October. The crash on the popular East Coast line left trains and cars lying zigzagged across the tracks in the island's deadliest rail accident for a quarter century. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The Daily Nation, one of Kenya's largest newspapers, is reporting Kenyan authorities have arrested seven officials with the China Road and Bridge Corporation for bribing investigators looking into corruption tied to the Standard Gauge Railway. The arrests mark the first time Chinese officials have faced charges linked to the SGR, which has garnered controversy since the inaugural run between Nairobi, the capital, and Mombasa, a major coastal city, in mid-2017. Agents with the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission arrested three Chinese nationals and four Kenyan officials, all of whom work for the CRBC and will face charges in court, according to The Nation. The commission says the bribe totaled 500,000 Kenyan shillings, or more than $4,800. The Nation cited unnamed sources with the railway who claimed the fraud under investigation amounts to about 1 million Kenyan shillings a day, or about $9,700. Based on an estimated 4,000 daily ticket sales and an average ticket price of $15.50, more than 15% of the daily revenue may be subject to fraud. In August, two top Kenyan officials were charged with corruption tied to land acquisition for the railway. The prosecutor's office identified more than a dozen other Kenyan officials and business people who had been arrested. Our thanks to VOA's Salem Solomon for contributing this story. Coming up, tariffs are taking the froth off of a favorite beverage. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. China is experiencing a boom in demand for the smelly, popular durian fruit in restaurants across the country, with chefs getting creative in their presentation. Malaysia is rushing to develop thousands of hectares to cash in on unprecedented export demand of durian fruit to China. There's much more on VOA 60 online. Also visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, U.S. tariffs on imported steel and aluminum, mostly from China, were moved by the Trump administration to bolster the domestic industry and protect U.S. jobs. Those tariffs are just beginning to have a far-reaching impact on different sectors of the U.S. economy, including the growing craft beer industry. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, one thing that wasn't in the business model for a new brewery in the Midwestern United States was the cost of tariffs that they would have and the impact on each can of beer.
When Dan Catt opened Good City Brewing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2016, he never imagined a trade war between the Trump administration and China.
I don't think we even contemplated that that administration would exist. We always planned to can our products. I don't think we necessarily expected to have probably our single biggest expense, packaging materials, have, you know, be directly impacted by tariffs.
Catt's cans are made of aluminum, about 30% of which is originally sourced from foreign suppliers, mostly China. The foreign aluminum is now subject to a 10% tariff. Dan Catt doesn't export to a foreign market, but he does depend on it for the aluminum to package his product and for steel used in the equipment that makes the beer.
We do buy equipment, stainless steel, that comes through China. So that's a concern for us as we look at continued growth and continuing to build capacity. I think we're definitely feeling a rush on anything that's metal. People are asking for premium prices on.
Catt says his company will continue to grow regardless of the short-term impact of the tariffs. But he hopes the U.S. and China can reach an agreement on trade before he has no choice but to pass the increased costs on to his customers. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
This news from VOA Asia. The Democratic Progressive Party of President Tsai Ing-wen is reassessing political strategies. After losing all but six mayoral and county magistrate seats, the first electoral test of its 2 years in the presidency, 15 seats went to the opposition Nationalist Party. It wants closer ties with China. A great strategy is to make a daily visit to VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after a diagnosis of breast cancer, many women have surgery followed by chemotherapy and radiation. But a new study shows that if the cancer is caught early enough, women might be able to avoid the chemotherapy. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
Since she was diagnosed with breast cancer last April, Amy Adam values family time even more.
It kind of, you know, made us aware that, you know, when it comes down to it, family is what matters.
Adam was lucky. A mammogram caught her cancer early, when the tumor was just 3 by 4 millimeters, smaller than the size of a pencil eraser. Her treatment, a lumpectomy followed by radiation.
No chemo. Did not have chemo.
Dr. Emily Albright is a surgical oncologist at the University of Missouri Healthcare. She says more women with early-stage breast cancer may be able to skip chemotherapy. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that genetic testing can determine the likelihood of the cancer returning. The study found women with a low risk of the cancer recurring did not benefit from chemotherapy. Women with a high risk of recurrence do better with chemotherapy. But Albright says doctors didn't know how to advise women in the mid-range.
The recent results have clarified that for women at intermediate risk of recurrence, the majority of those do not benefit from chemotherapy.
With genetic testing, doctors can determine the likelihood of a woman's cancer returning. Most people know that nausea, hair loss, and fatigue result from chemotherapy. But chemotherapy can also cause heart and nerve damage. Albright says the results of this study will help many patients whose breast cancer is caught early.
As we learn more about the biology, we're able to tailor treatments to the specific type of tumor that a patient has. So there are some small tumors that may be more aggressive, and there may be some larger tumors that are less aggressive.
Screening was key in catching Amy Adams' cancer. Mammograms can detect a lump 2 years before a woman can even feel it. Adams said it was a huge relief not to have to undergo chemotherapy. Because of this study, more women will be able to get treated without the negative side effects of chemotherapy. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
As the impact of climate change is becoming clearer, experts say the world needs to do more than just stop producing greenhouse gases. Aggressive steps also must be taken to put them out of the atmosphere. While engineers puzzle over high-tech solutions, scientists say nature offers tools that are ready to go today. The world's grasslands can soak up tons of carbon dioxide. VOA's Steve Barragona visited a Texas cattle ranch working to restore overgrazed land so it can join the fight against climate change.
Cattle graze on thigh-high grass at the G-Bar C Ranch in northern Texas. This is where Meredith Ellis grew up. Now she's raising her 4-year-old son here.
Everything I do, I think about him now, and I think about his future, and what is this world going to look like when he's my age?
Ellis worries about the droughts, floods, and other calamities he may face from climate change. That's a big reason why she raises her cows a bit differently than most. Her fields look like meadows, where others look like lawns. Jeff Goodwin with the Noble Research Institute says it matters because grass takes carbon dioxide from the air and sends it to the roots.
The more forage production that we're getting, the deeper the root systems, the more carbon we're sequestering out of the atmosphere.
This is the starting point, and on the other side of that fence is the end point. So can you tell a stark difference between these weeds and those golden native grasses over there.
If allowed to rest and reseed, Ellis says overgrazed land like this can start to recover in a year or two. Worldwide, an area the size of Mexico is overgrazed, by one estimate. Goodwin and the Noble Research Institute are working to change that. They're developing a marketplace that rewards ranchers like Ellis, who are working to restore the land, capture carbon, and more.
I don't think carbon's the answer. It's not the only answer. If we build a carbon market, I don't think we'll be as successful as if we build an ecosystem service market.
That's because a healthy ranch ecosystem does more than just store carbon.
Rainfall starts up on the prairie and percolates all the way down through those roots and finally empties into this creek. So by the time it gets here, it's crystal clear. It's like we have a giant Brita filter is what this is.
That means cleaner drinking water for people downstream. That's worth money. And that's just the start.
We have the intentions on building a strategy and a framework to be able to tack on biodiversity or other ecosystem services that our producers are providing today. They're just not being compensated for.
So this is an endangered orchid.
Ellis says the money may encourage more ranchers to do what she does. But that's not why she does it.
Like, how do you quantify that, you know? How do you quantify the monarch butterflies that need to rest here? You know, how important to humanity and our planet is that? And I think it's extremely important and not something to overlook.
Some major food and beverage companies are interested in the market. By 2022, Noble hopes to be rewarding ranchers for doing the right thing. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Cook County, Texas.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. No matter where you are in the world, there are many great ways to hear our program. Of course, one of our favorites is on the radio. Listen to Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. They carry our program, and we thank everyone there who's tuned in today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Aiden Utku. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.